So I'm going to speak in English, if you don't mind. And the subject for tonight is voices in the mind. Voices in the mind. And I think that we now discovered during these days of practice that there's an awful lot of chatter that's going on all the time in our minds. It can be in the form of words, it can be in the form of perceptions, means impressions. It can be in the form of music. It can take many kinds of forms, but it seems to be a real jumble, a real mess, a soup, marak, of quite chaotic content in the mind. And it seems to be very, very random. If you're watching your thoughts, most people feel rather shocked at how they seem to be so undirected, so chaotic, such a mess, jumping here, jumping there. I remember watching in one retreat a grasshopper, chargol, that was jumping in the grass to there, and then to there, and then to there. And I was thinking, does it ever get home? And I feel a little bit like that with the thoughts. I mean, is there a home, a place where they're going? And in a way, the more we touch silence, the more crazy our thoughts seem to be. That is, the more quiet we are, the more we see the thoughts, and when we see the thoughts, we see their craziness. They can be in the past. Somebody in this retreat said to me that their thoughts were send them back to songs of the childhood, songs of they're repeating again and again in the mind, and I guess that the thoughts can take you back so that all you're really doing is like a baby, and it's rubbish. It's just baby talk. Or they can take you in the future, and you're weaving fantasies of the future that have no connection whatsoever to the reality, and that's going on all the time, in the past, in the future, or planning, or whatever. So the Buddha had a word for this, which is translated in the English as perplexity, which needs, I think, really is bilbul. Perplexity is everything is a big puzzle, and it leaves you confused. There is no sense of completely stopped by the confusion of thought. And he gave examples of the kind of thoughts that stop us, that what will I be? What will happen to me? What was happening? What is it that was that made me as I am now? What kind of self am I really? And where did it come from? And these kind of questions, which really are inside meeting ourselves in thoughts, he said, are just turning wheels of confusion. So what we want to do, what all of us want to do with thinking, is to some extent shut it up. All of us wish that our thoughts would just leave us alone and quieten down. And we may take this further and actually make a theory of meditation, that the theory of meditation is stopping thought. And we'll talk about that later, because that's not exactly the theory of meditation. The purpose of meditation is not stopping thought. But I can understand, we can all understand why we want that, because the thoughts are just such a mess. And indeed, so at least we want to quieten them down. And also we want to obtain answers that the thoughts don't give us. And someone else on the retreat said to me, well, what's all this looking at body, 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 body? I mean, where am I going to solve my problems? and we want our thoughts to be more useful, more effective, solving our problems, or cutting through the mess. One extraordinary thing about thinking that we may already have discovered, and it's a very powerful insight, is that somewhere in this mess is me. That means this mess actually is me. We identify with the mess so much that we know ourselves through our thoughts. I think that, I'm like that, I want that, I look like that, I feel like this, other people look at me like that. All the things that I know about myself that can say, that's me, is through thinking. How do I know myself? I know myself through my mind, through my thinking. I wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and I recognize me, not somebody else. We know ourselves through our thoughts. So it's a mystery. How is it, if we know ourselves through our thinking, that it's such a mess? Through the mess I know myself. What's going on? That's an important insight. It's not something to be put away. It's something to be discovered and looked at. And it's a clue, a key to something that can free us. I'm going to go back to it. One of the ways in which we know ourselves is by our views, endot, okay, positions about life. So we develop strong positions, and the position can be many different kinds. I'm an Israeli. I believe in something. I believe in something and they don't believe. Therefore, we have to go to war to fight them. Or they threaten me. That's written in the books, and that's written in the politics, and that's written in the newspapers. They threaten me. Therefore, we have to fight them. When you consider the views, I mean, my favorite example is the view of America that it was bringing freedom to Vietnam, and in the process killed 3 million people in the name of freedom. It's a view. We have freedom. We want to bring it to the world. In order to bring it to the world, we might have to kill 3 million people, but it's a view, and it's right, and it's correct, and it's in the world. So you can see how powerful views are, beliefs are, but they are located in the mind. And so there's another paradox, that views which are so drastic, which will more or less destroy the world, we have a view that we are owners of the world. It's a basic view since the beginning of civilization. I own the world, therefore I can put concrete, cut down trees, you know, it's a view. The world is mine. I can take out the minerals, I can harvest it, I can cut the Amazon, whatever I like to do, because it's mine. That's a view. The Aborigines didn't have it. had another view. But so we destroy the world through views. They are extremely powerful. You can easily get up and kill somebody because of a view. But where is the view? In this jumble of thoughts, which is chaotic things going on in the mind, where's the view? Such an amazing paradox. Doesn't make sense. One thing I think that Buddhism and Judaism have in common, by the way, and something I like in both great religions, is both of them minimize belief and maximize action. Both Buddhism and Yadut and Judaism don't encourage you to have strong beliefs as a sign that you're religious. You are religious if you have strong beliefs. It's not a Jewish way, it's not a Buddhist way. But you can see where it comes up anyway. I mean, we think about, I don't know, today, the Hitnatkut. Very strong views about whether the house should be there. If you look in from a satellite, you know, above the planet, you can see big fight about whether the house should be there or 3 miles away on another bit of sand. Okay, I know that there's a strong issues there, but if you look, just take a big step back, in a, like an innocent child, there's a lot of views in that, and heat, and so you can see how the views are strong, and they're in the mind, and yet the mind is full of balagan. So I want to talk for a few minutes about Buddhist psychology, try and understand this a little bit. The Buddhist psychology has an interesting view of thought. Buddhist psychology says that thought, memory, and impressions in the mind are similar to the objects that the senses see in the world. That the mind is like a sense, like khush, od khush. The mind is a sense. And like the eye sees a curtain, a light, a window, a person, quite random. We when I turn my head, other stuff comes. The smell, I have no control. Smell is sweet smell, bad smell, good smell, toilets are clean, good smell, toilets are dirty, bad smell. I'm not in control. So, like that with the mind, thoughts come as information to the mind. And the mind is a kind of another form of antenna. That picks up things, and that's thought. So we're not really in control of thought. It's content, impressions coming in, but from the mind itself, from the memory, from the unconscious, and it needs, like all senses, the senses work through having an object, through having a sense, and to having consciousness. So in the case of the thought, thought is the object, or memory is an object, it needs consciousness to receive it, and the sense is a mind, the sixth sense. Mind, nose, eyes, tongue, touch, etc. So on top of that, there is layers of influences on this process, such as intentions, such as perceptions, such as many different layers and influences on this process. History, habits, formations, called sankharas, formations in the mind, which are kind of patterns, on top of the simple act of sensing a thought. So that's basically how the Buddhist psychology would look at thought in a simple way, and it already says if thought is a kind of a sense, then I'm not able really to control it, because it's coming up, it's material that comes up, but more or less by itself, because I'm turning my head and I see a light, so I turn my mind a little bit and I have a thought about a cup of tea, and so it's kind of a random, half random kind of things that come into the mind. And I think we can add to that a more Western model of the pyramid, that the mind is kind of processing, and the processing that's going on is at the top of the pyramid, or the top of the iceberg, or the kirchhorn. Right at the top is the conclusions we make about the world, but that's based on a whole kind of under the water huge world of impulses and fragments and partly thoughts and impressions and unconscious stuff and history and just a great pile of mental, I would say, basement stuff, junk that's in the basement, and all that is serving conclusions about life. And we're only interested in the conclusions, but they're based on all that stuff that comes out in dreams at night, when we, all the craziness of the mind looks very sensible. When we meditate and watch the craziness, it looks crazy, but in the night it looks very sensible. Anything can happen in a dream. But also when we meditate, we touch the unconscious. And that's one of the reasons why our thoughts are so crazy, like dreams sometimes, because we're actually giving room by samadhi or mindfulness, together with mindfulness, attention and quietness and steadiness, we give room to material to come up. And this material comes from layers that we don't usually pay attention to, which are usually closed because it doesn't help us to function in life, in daily life. So it's open and stuff comes, and it can be, as I said, all kinds of stuff from the past and from and all kinds of crazy things. So we are, in a way, opening the gate to a flood of stuff, and that's one of the reasons why we feel our thoughts are so chaotic. Processing that goes on in the mind, the ibud, the processing of the mind, can be paralyzing to us. The processing of the mind is meant, what is this processing for? It's meant to help us understand the unknown, the things we don't know, the future, for example. The intensity of thinking is often about trying to understand the unknown, what we don't know, what will happen to us tomorrow, what I ought to become, just like the Buddha said, what I ought to become, what I want to be, what I want to happen to me tomorrow, how I'm going to do the best things for myself. A lot of the processing energy is trying to get the best from me. That's the self using the mind to create the best conditions. That is, what are the best conditions for the self? As much known as possible, to reduce the unknown. That's the best conditions for the self. The self wants everything to be known. Predictable, say in English. Predictable. The self wants it all known. That's impossible. Life will not allow it. Therefore, the mind keeps running at 100 miles an hour, full gas for neutral, in order to try and understand the unknown, which it cannot possibly understand. You see this in choices. I mean, some people are paralyzed by choices. You go into a supermarket, I find it myself, I find it difficult in very small things to choose one thing and one thing next to it, I find really difficult. And sometimes I can stand there because it's hard. Whether to get married or not, it's okay. I'm okay with that. But to choose a red or a blue, it's the attempt to make ourselves secure. The mind is busy trying to make ourselves secure. It's driven by insecurity. The intensity of thought is driven by insecurity. One teacher once said, Ajahn Sumedho, if you think it, it means you don't trust it. Beautiful. If you think it, it means you don't trust it. And it's a deep truth, because a lot of our thinking is serving insecurity, trying to work out how not to be threatened. And you can see this mostly with emotion. Because as soon as there is an emotion, and most emotions like anger, fear and so on are based on a response to threat. And what happens when we have anger or fear? Thinking, well, what's going to happen now? I've got to do this, I've got to do that. You know, how do I do it so that it doesn't hurt me? And he's bad, and he did this, and he did that, and he did that, and he did that, or she did this, and she did that. The mind going crazy because of with emotion. Emotion generates a huge amount of thinking. And we might experience this in the retreat. If we feel ourselves thinking like crazy, check what's the emotion going on behind that. You might find, if you look carefully, that it's being driven by an emotion of fear or insecurity, even if the emotion isn't very clear. Agitation, anxiety, charada, it doesn't matter. Something is driving. One thing that the thoughts do is they come in chains. Thoughts tend to come in chains. One thought tends to bring another, tends to bring another. This is the famous example of the monkey. Because in the Eastern tradition, the thought is seen as a monkey. Because the monkey jumps, and he keeps jumping, but he does jump from one branch of the tree to another. So he holds on to one branch, and then he goes to the nearest one and jumps there. And then he goes to another one and jumps over there. But there's still a kind of a chain of one linking in somewhere or other, even if chaos, and it seems like it goes on and on and on. And this is called papancha, chains. And the image I have in mind is from Winnie the Pooh. Pooh Adob. Because if you remember, when Pooh has some kind of a party, he invites Rabbit. And Rabbit doesn't come alone, but comes with a whole chain of different creatures who are all somehow the friends and relations of Rabbit. And each one is a bit different, but they're all connected by a sort of a friend and relation relationship. And they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, by the way, until they come to the little ones which they always get lost, and you have to find them on the back of the neck, somehow they've fallen down. You know the story. But the image I have in mind of papancha, of one thing bringing a chain of associations with it, and it just tends to keep on going. So how do we work with thought in a spiritual practice? How do we work with thought? The first way, I think, is something that we've been doing here already, which is a quality of calming, a quality of settling down. If we are attentive to the body, pay attention to the body, and work with the body, and feel calm, like it said in the ancient text, Breathing in, I calm the mind. Breathing out, I calm the mind. I release the mind. Breathing in, I calm the mind. There is something about breathing, paying attention to the breathing, paying attention to the body, that calms the mind. There is something also that works in the opposite direction, that our concentration and attention can also make us sensitive, and then we see more. So it's as if we calm the mind, but we see more mind. So there's the working in two directions, and that's sometimes why we can feel, in some times we can feel very calm and quiet, and the mind is slowing down. But at other times we feel a lot of thought is happening, we feel agitated. And the two can happen together. Sometimes sensitivity opens and sometimes calmness, depending on the mixture of events and our practice. But generally, quiet, calm, breathing, concentration would tend to quieten the mind. And it makes it less powerful and less chaotic. There is an old image of the elephant, the mind being an elephant. And indeed, the mind power is huge. It's huge. You can see it in belief, how belief can break a mountain. And that's the power of mind. Belief is something that collects the whole mind and directs it. So the power of mind is huge. But it's chaotic. So practice of mindfulness meditation is one of the images is that the object of meditation is a stick, our awareness is a rope, and the mind is tied to the rope. So slowly we the mind is an elephant with huge power, but it's crazy. So slowly we train it by returning to the object, such as the breath, with attention, and slowly training the elephant to be less chaotic, less crazy. But that's not enough, because we really need also to see the mind, not just to calm it. Because the mind, as I say, is so powerful and is directing us and can be so destructive, and can be so destructive on ourselves, and can be so reducing energy and paralyzing us, and so destructive on other people also. We need to face the mind, to look at the mind, to look at thought. And so far, in the early part of the retreat, we really worked only with body. But there's no reason why we couldn't extend our ability to look, to see with attention, also at thought. And when we see that our thought is chaotic, we already did it. We already saw something important. That our thought is crazy and chaotic is an important insight. The chaos inside, meeting the chaos inside, is an important insight. Because if we do that, we begin to take our thoughts less seriously. Because if it's such a chaos, really, so we don't need to believe everything it says. And even more than that, if we look at this chaos and say, wow, that's me. That's who I am. I'm the person I am because of all these crazy thoughts. This is another level of insight. It tells us how we're made, that we ourselves are made from all this changing, chaotic stuff. The identity itself is associated, connected with this thinking, which is crazy. So it's an important insight. It makes us less obsessed with the truth of everything we think, with that the world is like that. We have a tendency to have a thought and say, that's the world. But if we look at the thought, we begin to say, no, maybe it's not the world. Maybe it's just thought. And that's a very important insight. Thought then in a way becomes, we understand it as secretions of the mind, hafreshot. Hafreshot, like the mouth is making saliva and the mind is making thought. And it's what the Buddhist psychology says, it's stuff that comes up, like things coming into the eyes, thought coming into the mind. Hafreshot. And science says thought is just molecules of salt that go in and out. That's all they are. So you're like, what? For that I write philosophy books because of ionim that go in and out of ta'im. That's philosophy books. I mean, there's a big, if we understood science actually here, we might also, it might shock us to into understanding more about thought. But generally, science is there, and us sort of in subjective experience is here, and we don't put the two together. But in a way, the thought is making constructions all the time. If we stop to believe them as the world, and we see the way they're like, as Jimi Hendrix says, castles in the sand that vanish into the sea gently, or something, that was his words, I forget exactly the word, gradually, yeah, something like that. That was one of his songs. It's castles in the sea, castles in the sand that melt into the sea gradually. The sense of things, thoughts coming and just melting away, thought coming and melting away, thought coming and melting away, and chaotic and melting. So how is that the world? Is that can we really rely on these thoughts? So in short, if we look at thought, it begins to reduce the authority that thought has over us. The authority, the samchut, the authority that there's a boss, we have to believe what's in the mind. The thought says something and we go, okay. The other thing that we can do by watching thought is cutting the chains of thinking. We have a power, and many of you may have used this and recognized it in the practice. We have the power simply to loci eta sheka, teka, sheka, to cut the whole chain, to take out the TV. We don't need to be trapped by this chain. We can cut it. We have the power to do it. We can say, no, now I'm going back to my breath. Now I'm being aware of my body. Now I'm getting out of this chain of thinking. I'm back here. And that too helps us. And brings us, it trains the elephant. It trains the elephant to be less crazy, or trains the monkey to be less crazy and more under our control, less controlling us, and more in our hands, in our control. So what's been very, very important, I would say, in my own practice, in my own life, has been to watch the playfulness of thought. To watch the way thought comes and goes as play. It's playful. It just comes and goes as it wants. There's a lot of play in it. It's not sure what it's trying to do. It's memory. It's many things, but it's playful. It's this, and it's this, and it's this. And you can stand back and watch this and not be stuck by it, not be into it, not be a slave to it. And just watch the play of it. Unfolding thought. Unfolding thought. Thoughts are not a problem. You don't need to stop them. They're not bad, which can be a kind of a view, actually, coming from more certain directions of spiritual practice, Eastern especially. That thought is bad, we have to put a big censura, censor, stop it. Thought is not bad. Thought is natural. The same thought that we want to reduce, we need it when next we read a word. We need a thought to understand. You need thought to understand what I'm saying now. So I must have thought. Thought is not bad. If we stop thinking, then I won't talk. You won't listen. I guess we'll go to sleep. I don't know. Nothing to do. It's not bad, but thought can be directed and thought can be quietened, and we can have a sense where we're free from the control of thought, so that we only need basically one thought to tell us what to do. We don't need endless thinking in order to work out what to do, what the future to do next. One thought is enough. We live more spontaneously. We think something and go and do it, and it's more clean, more clear, more direct. So, another aspect of thinking, another wisdom that we can obtain from thinking, from watching the thinking, is this issue of identity, the me. Where am I in the middle of all this thinking? And if I am associated, I am written into thinking. The thinking is what tells me I'm me, and the thinking is so uncertain, so crazy, so much in chains, so uncontrolled, then it tells us that the me itself, where is it? If the thoughts are like nothing much, but come and go, playful, so maybe the me is also like that. It tells us something about the me. It tells us to take, if we take the thoughts less seriously, we take ourselves less seriously. And that's anatta, a liberating understanding. We don't need to take thoughts about ourselves seriously, thoughts about our life so seriously. We don't need to, therefore, we know that we ourselves, we don't need to take ourselves so serious or so self-important. We can have a sense of openness and freedom through understanding thinking, through watching thinking. When we practice watching thinking, what we do is just knowing that it's a thought, and knowing a thought that comes, and knowing a thought that goes. It's not believing the content of the thought. The thought comes with a message, like a message might be, so I said, I want a cup of tea, or I'm going home in 2 days, what do I do? It's a thought. It's just a thought. So you've got two possibilities. You can actually get into the subject, the story, and get into it with papancha. What am I going to do when I go home 2 days' time? How I'm going to cope? What's going to happen? How I'm going to fit? How will I fit what I've learned here in the future? Will it be bad? Will it be good? You can spend your time believing the messages of thought. Or you can say, oh, here is a playful thought called the future. Oh, okay. Hello, thought about the future. How are you? Bye-bye. What's next? And relating to thought as thought and not believing its content. Not having to, I would say, be identified with the story. As ever, we can be helped a little bit by something can help us, which is the fact that our relationship to uncontrolling crazy thinking is rather painful. There's something about the chains of thought that hold us tight which is painful. is always the fact in practice, especially Buddhist practice, that it's a good idea to see a painful element in things, because in conditioned life there is pain, or there is limitation. It's uncomfortable. There's something basically uncomfortable about it. And it's quite helpful to see that. In whatever, to see dukkha, to see the painful element of life, it's not something bad to do. It's something good. It can help us. Just like Simi said, welcoming a guest. It gives us an insight. If we understand that the control of the crazy mind is painful, it leads us like Pinocchio, like a puppet. It leads us like a puppet in all kinds of difficult situations. It makes us have a difficult life. It makes us not be able to really really manifest ourselves. It leads us in directions that we can be 20 years in the wrong direction because of we're thinking like this and thinking like that. It can be very difficult. There's something about the control of thought that creates confusion and creates difficulty. And the more thinking we do, sometimes the more painful it is. And we're turning it round and round and round and round and round and round. It's painful. So recognize the pain can sometimes help us just to turn away from the control of thought and say, well, wait a minute, you know, I can turn away from it. I don't need it. And it's good, in a way, as an antidote to putting thought on the bhama, on a level of high level, and say, ah, well, that's... Especially in the Western world, we do this. Thought is the way we work out our life problems. Thought is the best way we work out things in our life. And we put it very high status. And the painfulness of it is something we forget. A large number of Western philosophers have quite a difficult life. You read a lot of pain in Western academics. And I know because I've lived all my life with Western academics. And stories you hear about private life, family life, private life of great academics, it's like frightening. That is all thoughts. And then when it comes to such a simple thing as how you relate to your children, can you really connect to your children, or can you really connect to others, or can you really feel the heart, or can you really live in a more open space with people, or can you really emanate kindness, and can you really help others, or can you really in some way be a role model, not just a talking mind, a talking mind, but can you really... So there's a big question there. And we've given a lot of authority to thought, especially in the Western world. So it's helpful for us to come down, to reduce the authority of this thought, and see that it can be a painful thing. So I want to kind of summarize by saying three things, by sort of suggesting there's three elements to this. The first element is really to quieten down thinking, just to quieten it down. The second element is the element of liberating thought, liberating ourselves through thought, seeing a thought for what it is. In the Tibetan practice, in Tibetan imagery, they say that thought is self-liberating. That is, if you just follow a thought, it sort of vanishes like a balloon, and you're free. And it's a beautiful image that thought is self-liberate. Thought, if you follow thought, it liberates itself and you. Doesn't matter if you don't understand it, but it's just a sense that thought is a bubble, and if you really see the thought as a bubble, it creates freedom. Bubble bursts, and you're free. So we ask, what is thought when we look at thought? We ask, what's between the thoughts? Where does the thought come from? What's the ground of thinking? And this is the liberating aspect of working with thought. This is the way thought can bring us to freedom, to see a bigger mind from which the thought comes, from which the thought is arising. It's like the waves in the ocean. The wave is a thought, it's a form, it's an impression, it's a creation. And it's made out of mind stuff which is free. The thought is made out of the wave, is the wave made out of the ocean. And what's the stuff of the wave and the stuff of the ocean? It's consciousness. So the touch of the thought can help us touch consciousness. But another element which is just as important, which is often forgotten, and that's the third element, and with this I want to conclude, the third element is actually taking the elephant or the monkey, the mad monkey or this big elephant that has so much power and is unused and destroys us, can destroy us and it can destroy others and make wars and so on. And we can learn to direct it. And this is a kind of different process from watching thought or from meditating on thought itself. This is a process where we begin to direct our thought to positive, wholesome, it's like nutrition, hazana, through moving our thought in the direction which is wholesome. And for example, if we understand, firstly, of course, that thought is not a problem, it's the natural, a natural power that we have, just like the blood that passes through the veins. And then, how do we use it? Well, for example, if we understand through thought what stops us, if we understand through thought the hindrances, for example, like Sumi said yesterday, we understand through thought that tiredness is not something that is just not a difficulty but an opportunity. Or we understand through thought that the things that are pushing us and pulling us are things to be understood. They're coming from our history, coming from our conditioning. If we understand through thought what is our conditioning, if we understand through thought our tendencies, our patterns, if we understand through thought that our mind is attached, our mind is non-attached. Now we're fixed on something, now we're free. Now we're tense, now we're open. Now we're contracted and frightened, now we're free. We can understand through thought the process of trust, and we can help it through thought, but there's nothing to be afraid of. These are processes where we use the thought in practice. We can use our thought to direct, to contemplate. Sometimes we use thought really to understand ourselves, and we have a moment of insight. And it's not that we should stop thought and say thought is bad. Have a moment of insight. I don't need to be so frightened. Maybe there's a strange phenomena here. Something I don't understand is happening to me. But I can trust, because trust is good for me. It's an act of thought. Trust is helpful. So these are directions of thinking that we can develop through our spiritual life. And using thought for wisdom, and directing thought towards these things, towards wisdom, towards what helps us. And so final sentence I want to say about the spiritual experience or something sacred, that the sacred, the mushu Yoter sacred, yoter subtle, adin. If you want to take the image of the Bible of Kol Dmama Daka, the still small voice, is something that thoughts generally block. We don't hear the subtle voices because our thoughts are often so strong and the mess in the mind takes up so much space that we cannot hear a Kol Dmama Daka, the thin, small, subtle voice, which is spiritual truth or something sacred in the world. And so there is a value in spiritually in reducing the power of thought and directing it to help us. And Thich Nhat Hanh, he says, each thought, each action in the sunlight of awareness becomes sacred. And in this light, no boundary exists between the sacred and the profane. Thank you. Profane means kadosh ve chol. Chol? Yeah. So no boundary exists between a kadosh ve chol.